From the album Life in a Day in 1979, the first song I ever heard from Simple Minds, the opening track from the record, a great song called Someone. And it's brilliant to welcome back to BBC Radio Scotland, Jim Kerr. How are you?
Good, Billy. Pleasure to be here. You might have to go easy on me because I think this is the first interview I will have done in 18 or 19 months. So as you can see, the brain might take a wee bit to get up to scratch. Sure, once we get going, we'll go on our old selves.
Another thing that you have not done for something like 18 months through no fault of your own is, like in common with just about every other band out there, you've not stepped on a stage. And for Simple Minds, who spend a lot of their waking hours, you know, living out of a suitcase and going from city to city, has it been tough for the past 18 months in the middle of all this COVID madness, not being able to get out and face your audiences?
Well, it's been mind-blowing. I mean, I was saying to you there, this is the first interview I've done in 18 months. The last interview I did was in Copenhagen, and it was the night before we played what was going to be, well, we did two shows actually. We did a matinee and also an evening show, and we knew after that that things were grinding to a halt. COVID had really kicked in then, places were starting to close down. UK hadn't yet, but Scandinavia, which is where we had been and where we were, they had already taken a decision. Germany. I mean, it was almost like we were dry. As we were getting out of countries, the borders were closing 3 hours later. It was, I mean, oh, you just couldn't believe it. But the last interview I did the previous night was with the New York Times. And the guy said, so, you know, how do you think this will pan out? I mean, this, you know, how are you going to get by? I said, 3 or 4 weeks, we'll be back. They'll sort it out. And lo and behold, as you've just pointed out there, coming up for almost 2 years, we're still, you know, tender hooks that this year will allow us to get out and play and do what we do best and do the thing that we're most known for.
But during that 18-month, two-year period, you and Charlie Burchill, guitar player from Simple Minds, have not been idle because you've actually been working on new songs and looking ahead to the next record, haven't you?
Well, that was the instant challenge. I mean, as soon as things ground to a halt, I mean, we're not good at not doing anything. And really, you couldn't do anything for the first, certainly the first 3 or 4 months, you know, because certainly I would write back to Scotland. I can tell people that the night before I left home at dinner with you, actually, you're a jinx. I think I said to you, well, see you in a year's time. Because that tour was starting in Scandinavia and it was going to end in Australia in December, 10 months later. Well, lo and behold, I was back about 10 days later. I just couldn't believe it. And so, like everyone else, it was like, what are we doing? We're locked down here. We're getting out 1 hour and stuff. But as you know, I've got a place, a studio, countryside in Scotland, and we had songs to work on. As you also know, I've been working on a book for the longest time. And within a few months, Charlie and I managed to, Charlie was in Holland at the time. We managed to organize some time in the studio in Hamburg. It was still open. You could still go into Germany at the time and all of that. And it was one of the few places where you could work without too much restrictions. And as you know, quite rightly say, we pushed on with a record that we keep thinking we've finished, but every time that happens, we're just about to go out the door and Charlie will come up with a new idea and we think, hang on a minute, that's really good. But for all intents and purposes, yeah, we do have a record finished, I think.
And Monday of this week, you released a single called Act of Love, which we're going to talk about in detail a bit later on in the interview, and it marked, you know, the 44th anniversary since your first ever gig, which again we're going to talk about a bit later on. And I guess that it's just an achievement in itself that 44 years on from this sort of crazy notion away back in 1977-78 that, you know, you're still writing songs and still performing and still as hungry as you were then, now.
Every time you put out a new record, every time you put out a new song, you know, you feel excited, you feel, in your own little way, you feel another milestone passed or another chapter in the story written. But this one really does feel something because the numbers, you know, the numbers start to stop me in my tracks now when you think, as you say, 44 years, not only just still to be playing and performing, but you're putting out a record or putting out a song with the attitude of Act of Love. We just love it. I mean, I don't know if you're meant to say when you put out a record, I love it, but the energy, it's classic Simple Minds. If you wanted a new song to kickstart a new phase, hopefully kickstart a new year, much better than the last 2 years, a feel-good, good song, full of energy, optimism, a young spirit, I think we managed to get all of that in this song. So, and it's a good taster, even though the song itself will go into the story, even though it's one of the first songs we ever wrote, it says a lot about where we are once again right now in terms of the sound of the other stuff that we've been working on.
Let's go back to the very beginning, because we're going to be talking about the early years on the programme tonight. How did kind of music start for you? How did it come onto your radar? Because I know that Charlie had an older brother who had a record collection, and he had kind of access to that. He could dip in and out. But you were the oldest child in your family. So were you watching Top of the Pops? Was it Whistle Test? Was it, you know, going into town on a Saturday and scraping up money to buy a record? When did it kind of start for you in serious terms?
I suppose it really started. I'm not an obvious Beatles fan in the sense, you know, there's real Beatles fans and they know everything about the Beatles and all that. I don't think I've ever, in all the times we have spoke about music, I don't think I've ever discussed a Beatles album with you, but I was a Beatles fan because my mum was a huge Beatles fan and she would get the records and, well, you know what she was like, you know, she was a young girl at times, she was still a young woman. She'd put them on, she'd dance, I'd jump around. So it started with that. But my dad, on the other hand, he was, I don't know where he got it. My dad knew some guys that were in the Merchant Navy. And we know the story that a lot of those guys, those Glasgow guys, they went all around the world and they came back with records, the blues, soul, country. And I think my dad worked with a few guys that introduced him to that. So on one hand, with the Beatles, but we had Johnny Cash and we had Hank Loughlin and Patsy Cline, and actually Glasgow's very big on that. Glasgow's huge on, well, we called it country western then, country music. So our house was a mixture of that. My dad's idols were Fats Domino and Little Richard, and so it was from that. It was just music in the background, and music you jumped up and down, and music that, you know, the neighbours and everybody, your aunties and your uncles would come on a Saturday night when the pub shut in Glasgow then at 9 o'clock. Everyone would go up to each other's house, have a sing song. You know, they would be the artist, that would be the music. But by the age of 11 and 12, you're right, I didn't have an older brother. It's funny, I was thinking that other guys in Simple Minds, they were all the babies in the family. I was the only eldest brother. They'd gone into music through their brothers, but as you well know, I lived in this high-rise block in Tory Glen, Glasgow, and I was really lucky because the elder guys, when I say elder guys, that were 3 or 4 years older than me, they were all into music. You know, you'd go in the elevator and somebody would be holding a T-Rex album, Electric Warrior, or they would have Yes, or of course, Zeppelin. And then I remember getting in one day to school, I nearly died. This guy was holding something under his arm. It was the first time I ever set eyes on Alice Cooper, Killer. And he said to me, oh, you got to go and see this guy. This guy hangs himself on the stage. There's guillotines, there's snakes. I don't know what's going on here. But those elder guys, come up and listen to it. And my education in music came through all of them, going right up through Springsteen. I remember hearing Springsteen way, way before Born to Run. It was Aysbury Park, Sparks, another of our favourites. I knew them from two albums prior to when they signed to Island and all of that. So it was really through that. I mean, my first, I don't mind saying it was a crush, because it was a crush, was Bowen. I mean, it's like, this is our Jesus. Well, that's what it seemed. There was nothing like it. You saw Bowen on Top of the Pops. There was just nothing like it. We thought it was Jesus, but as somebody says, it was only John the Baptist. Jesus was coming a year later.
We're going to talk more about the early years, but let's have a track, the earliest track that we ever heard from you in a musical sense. Let's go back to 1977 on the Chiswick record label, a single by Johnny and the Self-Abusers. This is the classic sound of Saints and Sinners. This is Billy Sloan on BBC Radio Scotland. You join me with my special guest, Jim Kerr of Simple Minds. And we're talking about, you know, your early musical education, Jim. You know, we get into, you know, 1977, there's the punk rock explosion. You think, you know, I want to be in a band. You know, what gave you the confidence to do that? Because you'd had a stab at it. There was the famous, or the now infamous, Biba Rom, who once upon a time played the children's Christmas party. You know, what made you, because you were a pretty shy guy by your own admission, what gave you the confidence to think, A, I'm going to write songs, and B, I'm going to stand up in front of an audience, in front of the microphone, and be the singer in the band?
I don't think I'll ever be able to work that out, because to put it in context, it's different now, and it's been different for a long, long time. But back then, we didn't know anybody who did that. So, you know, it's not like, well, you saw your cousin doing it, or, you know, your sister's boyfriend was in a band or something. We didn't know anybody who did that. But I think what it was we were a gang from school. I mean, I just can't really, I can't really separate myself from Charlie and Joe Donnelly and Tony Donald and those guys that were in my class in school, Brian McGee. Everyone was starting to get into music then, but they were going the extra mile. They were buying guitars, or the mums and dads were buying them guitars and basses and drum kits and all of that. And at the same time, the real big thing was going to see bands playing live, because, you know, Glasgow now, and the way Glasgow's been for the last few decades, you know, everyone wants to go. It's a happening city, arts, culture and all that. But you'll be my witness, it wasn't like that back then. There really wasn't much going on.
But we did have the famous Glasgow Apollo.
That was the temple. So we had this concert hall, and we had the audiences as well, because still, between the venues, I say it really was the audiences. It was the audience that always made it. But it seemed to be that a lot of bands would start their tour in Glasgow. I remember, right, you would maybe see Roxy Music and the Whistle Test on a Tuesday night, or Genesis with Peter Gabriel, and then the Wednesday, the music papers would come. Each day there would be another paper, NME, Melody Maker Sounds, and then the Friday, I think the agents probably think, we'll send them up to the jocks, you know, to start it, because they'll be a bit rusty the first night and stuff. So they, on the other hand, the opening night was arguably the most exciting night of the tour. So I just started to go to gigs then. There was nothing like it before, and there's been nothing like it since. There's nothing to touch it. A great music concert, to watch great, great performers. And I certainly didn't think, oh, I'm going to do that. Nothing like it. But I did think, I'll do anything to be involved in this world, this planet. I'll do anything to be involved in it. So lo and behold, the guys at school, I just started off kind of, you could say, encouraging them, maybe get it together or find a rehearsal place. Or we used to rehearse in St. Bridget's School, the primary school. I was always pushing for things to happen. And you know, we got all the pieces together. The one thing we couldn't find was a singer. And one night, I guess Dutch Courage, maybe had been drinking too much cider. I said, okay, I'll sing, but as long as you promise not to tell anyone, because it's so embarrassing. Charlie reminds me that we're still waiting for the real singer to come. I'm just keeping someone's seat warm.
And I mean, when you moved on from there to Johnny and the Self-Abusers, you know, it was almost like kind of two bands in the one. Did you think you had a kind of serious chance of doing something? Because, of course, famously, when you signed the record deal with Chiswick, which was a pretty happening little indie label in West London at that time, Saints and Sinners was released on the day that the band split up. So why did it never go beyond that?
There was a couple of things that were, from the very first Johnny and the Self-Abusers, and I have to say, you know, the more we dwell on that and thinking about the Johnny as in Johnny and Self-Abusers was John Malarkey, who everyone in Glasgow knows, yeah. and was then in the Cuban Heels, and a really talented guy. It was his band, really. He sort of pulled Charlie and I into it. You know, he knew we were into the same kind of music. By this time, we were hitchhiking up and down to London and to see Doctors of Madness and Ultravox, and it was kind of punk, just to start the post-punk. And John had this vision for a band, and same thing. Got the gig and then said, it's happening in 2 weeks' time, are you in? And I think we were kind of the first or the only punks in Shawlands, that side of the city, well, us and our pals. And before we knew it, he'd drafted Charlie and I in. And I have to say that usually when people start a band and usually when they talk about their first gig, it's terrible because there's two men and a dog there and it all goes badly and nobody cares and, you know, you find out the reality. Your dreams are shattered in the first gig. However, in the case of Johnny the Self-Abusers, you remember this. There was, again, the hand of fate came in, and there was a technicality at the time in Glasgow where there'd been a bit of a riot at the Stranglers gig.
At the City Hall, yeah.
And the City Fathers had taken it on themselves. It was a technicality where visiting punk bands or something had been banned. Well, we weren't visiting. We were from there. And so this Johnny and the Self-Abusers, we put our posters up all over the record shops and all that. Had our first gig in Shawlands thinking, there'll be two men and a dog and some of your pals. And we turned up and I just wanted to get in the van. It was McGee's van and drive away because it was a queue around the block because every punk in Glasgow that had been kind of starved of that kind of vibe had turned up. From the very first chord, the place went mental. I mean, it just went mental as in an expression. Here it was, you know, punk, local punks. I mean, to say we were bad is an understatement, but that didn't matter. I maintained it within that minute. You know, Charlie and I knew that the band was a bit of a joke. We knew that that wouldn't go anywhere. But there was something in that first minute we maintained. We looked at each other and went, hang on a minute. Imagine you could do this for real. And so I maintained that the summer from then on in was a bit of a learning curve to what would be the real thing, which was Simple Minds coming 6 months later.
We're going to talk about that in a few moments' time, but let's go back to 1979. The band's debut album was a great record called Life in the Day, and this is one of the big singles from it, Simple Minds and the Sound of Chelsea Girl. You joined me on BBC Radio Scotland in conversation with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds. And we were talking just before Chelsea Girl there, Jim, about you thinking, you know, looking at Charlie and thinking this could be serious. But, you know, when you sat down with him, you know, in the High Flats in Tory Glen to write songs, which I presume was something that neither of the two of you had ever done before, there was a bit of the old Lennon and McCartney about it, in as much as it was quite literally nose to nose. You would sit at the kitchen table and he would have his guitar and you would have your notebook and you would try and come up with something. How did it work?
Well, it was very much like that. And, you know, to add to it, we had no recording equipment. This was before Walkman, and you know, and we didn't have the money for a real tape and all that stuff. So we would sit on the couch, mum and dad's house or Charlie's room. His brothers had guitars, so we'd go over there. Really, depending on when the houses were quiet, Charlie would have a few chords. You know, I would. What about that bit? And what about this bit? And maybe if that middle bit was the start bit, we didn't know what a bridge was. We hardly knew what a verse and chorus was. We had no teaching of any sort. There was no mentors. Then we'd go back to it 2 days later and we would have an argument because we couldn't remember what bit was what bit. Somehow, we managed to get these songs one by one that excited us. And that's the only thing you can, even to this day, it's the only thing you can go on. Because, you know, music's subjective. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. You think you know. That was really the genesis of our songwriting partnership, which I have to say pretty soon afterwards, Act of Love, which is, I guess, you'll come up to. So I think about the third or fourth song we wrote. And it's time to confess. I mean, people used to say to me, at what point did you think Simple Minds had a chance of going beyond just being a local band. I used to always say, well, we didn't think about that. You know, we were just, it was the next gig and all that stuff. But with Act of Love and with a riff in Act of Love, when Charlie came up with that, I remember thinking, well, if Charlie can come up with this stuff, I mean, maybe there's a chance. So I guess some people talk about football players, they see a young kid now, if you go back and you say, look, it's there, it's already there at that age. And I would say, in the case of Charlie Burchill, it was just there.
Things happened very quickly. You released, you know, Johnny and the Self-Abusers, Saints and Sinners in November of 77, split up that day. And then, you know, on the 17th of January 1978, you get your real big break when you were part of a four-band bill, a punk rock show at Satellite City in Glasgow. And, you know, top of the bill were Steel Pulse, who at that time were in the lower reaches of the charts with a single called Ku Klux Klan. Second in the bill were Revolting and the Backstabbers, who a few years later morphed into James King and the Lone Wolves. First in the bill were a group called the New Sonics, who of course went on to become Orange Juice. And sandwiched somewhere in the middle was Simple Minds. First of all, how did you get the gig? And it must have been a real big deal, because Satellite City would have been the biggest place that you'd ever played.
I remember David Henderson, who we all know. David and Jane Henderson were a big part of our gang.
Yeah, your sound engineer and your line engineer, yeah.
Exactly. And I think by this time we were sort of, you know, joining the Self-Abuse. Summer was over and it was time to get real. And we found ourselves rehearsing in this dilapidated factory in the Gorbals, where the guy very kindly let us use the attic to make as much noise, and more importantly, it was free. And I remember we'd only been in about 2 weeks, and this was, so by this time it's possibly the start of December, and David came in and says, I've got a gig for you, you know, I've got a gig, it's Satellite City, 17th of January, which was just over a month away. If David hadn't done that, you know, I think there's a lot of people, sometimes a lot of people, they start off and just getting up and doing it for the first time is so important. And in our case, to be up there. And I remember how much it meant to us. I mean, did I think we were ready? Probably not, but with songs like Pleasantly Disturbed, which I think is still arguably one of Simple Minds' greatest songs, Act of Love was our opening. So it was always important to have, your first song was really, really important, and Act of Love was the first song of the set, because when people don't know your stuff. I remember walking on that night, we walked on to the sound of our own footsteps, but Charlie hit that riff. And I could feel the energy in me straight away. And before I knew it, we were off. And although I was saying we weren't ready, I think we already had something about us. I mean, we had a look, we had all those years ago to watch. When I say going to watch great bands, people say, well, what is a great band? What makes a great band? You well know that 3 years ago to the Apollo, you could tell the difference between a good live band and a great live band. And if you were a front person, you have to have something a wee bit different from you. I mean, years of watching Alex Harvey and Steve Harley and Brian Ferry and all of that, you had to have an attitude and you had to have a sound. And I think we already had that under our belt from the first gig, and fortunately, people responded to it.
Now, you opened the show with Act of Love. It was one of a six-song set that you played, and you weren't very punk rock. You were more art rock than punk rock than anything else. And shortly afterwards, you know, a few months later, you found yourselves in Savas Studios in the basement of St Vincent Street in Glasgow, and you actually recorded some of your first ever demos. And we've actually got the Act of Love demo. I'm just going to let you hear a little bit, but so have a listen to this.
Yeah.
What was going through your mind? Because, you know, 18 months earlier, you hadn't been anywhere near a recording studio, and you're suddenly in a proper place with proper equipment. There's an engineer through the glass, and you're essentially making a record. So when you hear that early, you know, recording of Act of Love, what goes through your mind?
Well, all the things you say, they're summing up the excitement of that. Here you are in this these hallowed places, a recording studio. Again, we'd never met him. They had been in a recording studio. And there we were, not only with a clock ticking, I think with 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. I mean, most of us were on the dole, so I think my dad gave us some money. Brian McGee's dad put up money. So all of that's great. But on the other hand, you think, this is it. You know, if this doesn't work, so it's your O-levels, it's your hires, it's your driving test, it's everything at the one time, because coming out of there, in your hand with a cassette that, again with David Henderson, I hitchhiked to London and went round dropping the cassettes off. And everything that's happened in our life is a result of what happened in that day, in that moment, in the track that you just played there. But for me, listening to it there, I think they already sound great. They just sound great. McGee sounds great. Duncan Barnwell, they just... Or maybe it's just me, Billy. Maybe I'm just a big fan of Simple Minds. I don't know. They sound great. They just sound great. And that's a demo.
A few months later, you know, you were lucky enough to get a record deal with Bruce Finlay's label Zoom that went through Arista. And you find yourself in the Townhouse in London, which is a real proper studio. And you're there with a named producer, John Leckie. And you start working on songs for what became Life in a Day. Mm. Why did Act of Love not make it onto the album? Did it kind of fall through the cracks? Or did you just think by that time you'd better songs and it get kind of pushed aside?
I think that's exactly what happened. I think it was our opening song, as I said. It was our big attitude song. It always went down well live. It was kind of your you made a statement with it. But I think we were starting to be so prolific that every time a new song came up, well, another song gets shunted to the side. We'll look at it later, and quite often that happens. And you always think, I'll go back to it. We can always go back to that. That's a great riff. Invariably, you don't. But finally, we had the opportunity to do so.
Well, let's hear it now. Released on Monday to celebrate the 44th anniversary of that now legendary gig on the 17th of January 1978 at Satellite City in Glasgow. Here's Simple Minds with their brand new 2022 version of Act of Love. Time to ignore every rule. Then it came.
was an act of love.
You join me in BBC Radio Scotland in conversation with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds. We heard the brand new single there, Jim, Act of Love. And of course, you know, things really took off very quickly in 78, getting into 1979. You know, you're recording an album, you're going out on tour, you play the Apollo. I remember you played the Apollo one night. I was there with Susie and the Banshees with Spizz Oil. And then I think I'm correct in saying you put the gear in the van and went through to another gig in Falkirk. Is that right?
We went through to Edinburgh. We opened for the Pleasers.
Yeah.
They were kind of hot to trot at the time, front cover of Enemy and such. But within a few months of signing to Arista Records, we found ourselves in the Old Grey Whistle Test, the iconic, legendary music show that we had sat, as I mentioned earlier, and watched all these amazing people. And there we were under that iconic sign, still not having played a gig outside of Scotland. Our gigs were still then Alloa, Arbroath, Stonehaven, Aberdeen, Falkirk, Stirling.
And you played with Gen X as well somewhere, didn't you?
We played with Gen X, and we opened for Generation X in Falkirk, and I remember they were the most glamorous thing I'd ever seen. We stood with our duffel coats on, kind of watching them getting off the bus. I mean, Billy Idol, he just looked like a Greek god. Took us about 10 minutes to blow them off stage. I mean, it just, they weren't very good. Well, you and I'll have an argument now.
We'll have an argument about that next week. That'll go on for hours and endless time. But I mean, you know, as I say, it happened very kind of quickly for you, and you get to the 1st of April, April Fool's Day. That's got to be prophetic, in 1979, and you release Life in a Day, and it's got the title track on, it's got Someone that we played at the start of the programme, it's got Chelsea Girl, it's got Wasteland on it, a whole load of other great tracks. But it almost seemed very unusual that, you know, within 3 or 4 months you were releasing another album in September of 1979, Real to Real Cacophony. Do you think, you know, the moment the record came out, you'd already almost outgrown Life in a Day?
Well, I can tell you the story of that. When we're making Life in a Day, on one hand it was really exciting, as you mentioned earlier, it'd be in these amazing studios and all the equipment and hearing your sound coming out, this beautifully produced sound, and John Leckie, famous producer. All of that was great, but I had this inkling of something about it I didn't like, and I couldn't articulate it. I just didn't know what it was. But everyone was coming down and saying, it sounds good, the Chelsea Girl sounded good, and it did sound good in a way, but it just didn't. You know, Simple Minds also had a darker side. Simple Minds also had an art rock side. I think it pushed, for me, it pushed too much the pop side. You know, you could see why people would want to do that. But I couldn't articulate it until we finished the album, we mixed it, we were getting in the van to drive back up to Glasgow, and somebody said, oh, have a listen to this on the way up. You'll like this. And it was Joy Division's Unknown Pleasure. And I just thought, oh, jeez, we've blown it. It was raw. It sounded like it was done in a fiver, well, it was in Stockport Studios or something. And it kind of reminded me, some of it reminded me of some of the demo recordings we had done or some of the vibes we had created live. And so I got back after listening to Joy Division and thinking, we're so not happening. This is what it should be. It reminded me of our earlier recordings and some of the vibes we'd created live. And I just felt our debut had been overproduced, was too shiny, too glossy, too well done, too poppy. Bruce said, there's no way they're going to ditch the album. Are you crazy? You're just nearly gone on and write your next one and perhaps bring out all these other dimensions that you're talking about. And so, as you say, within 6 months, we had Reel to Reel, and that started to establish us as, you know, not just being kind of mainstream fodder.
We're going to be seeing you very, very soon, because after a long, long period, you're finally going to be playing with A Bit of Luck, fingers crossed, in Scotland. The dates are the 5th of April at the P&J Arena in Aberdeen, the 6th at the Hydro in Glasgow. Then we move later into the year, on the 12th of August, you're playing that outdoor gig at Princess Street Gardens. Looking forward to be back on stage in Scotland again.
Absolutely. I mean, we're just looking forward to playing, but of course... Well, let's go back to the start of the interview. We're talking about how much it means. If you had asked us when we made our debut that day, you know, if you'd said to us then, what's your hopes, what's your dreams for this, what's the desires? We didn't know about record sales there. We didn't know about the riches. We didn't know about the rewards. But I think we would have said to you, we want to be in a great live band. We want to take it around the world. And... we want to try and get a lifetime out of it. I'm sure, I don't know if we'd have been able to come up with a third, but I'm sure it had been in the back of our mind. And the fact that, thanks to our fans, people like yourself who's supported us throughout, all that has come to pass.
Well, 44 years and counting, and I'm sure there's a few more years left in Jim Kerr and Charlie Butcher. We're going to finish, Jim, with a song. And for all that you were saying that you thought Life in a Day was the kind of more poppy side of Simple Minds, you walk on stage on the 17th of January 1978 at Satellite City in Glasgow. There's 300-400 punks there. They just want to hear punk rock. Charlie's got a violin and a Flying V guitar. Great. And you play an 8-minute long song called Pleasantly Disturbed. Now, if that wasn't taking a chance, I don't know what was. I mean, it was a very adventurous song, not only for your record, but for your first ever gig. Where did it come from?
Well, you know, he's a good friend of yours now, but Steve Harley was a huge influence on Simple Minds. And songs like Sebastian and some of his epics... I have to think, I mean, we could never play like Cockney Rebel. We never had that kind of talent. But somewhere within the epicness of some of his songs and the drama. Unfortunately, just at that time, Glasgow was a bit on its knees. And drugs and all that had become everyday norm now. It was just kind of starting then, and really the tragedy of it. We pulled Pleasantly Disturbed out of that.
Let's hear it now then. We'll see you very, very soon. Thank you very much indeed for joining us in the programme. Don't forget, Act of Love, the brand new single from Simple Minds, was released on Monday. And let's go back to 2012, the 5x5 live box set. And this is a brilliant version of Pleasantly Disturbed. Thanks very much, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you.